Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, happy new year to everyone that's listening to us from tomorrow onwards. Hooray, it's not 2020 anymore. It's another rubbish year.
No.
At the moment it is. But it's the trajectory is upwards. With 2020, the trajectory was downwards, and that's not very good. I mean, unless you started off the year with a crippling eye infection. But it's fine because we're going to start off on a sinking low, and then we're going to climb up to high heights. But we don't know when, but we'll get there.
We're doing podcasts as well, so that just partially mitigates the sinking lows of the early months of the year. And I'm just not having any more pessimism because I can't take it.
No, it's okay. I've acquired a puppy now, so I'm all about the optimism.
Right.
I can do lockdown now. Matt, how are you? Happy New Year. Not quite. We're recording this on New Year's Eve, but you may well be listening to it in the year 2021 from the future.
We're not a party, don't we? This is it.
Yeah. What are everyone's big plans for tonight?
Sleeping. I was concerned when David said he's had enough of pessimism and he's talking to us. That concerns me.
Yeah.
We need to be more optimistic.
I've got enough optimism for the three of us. Don't you worry. It's fine.
he certainly does, folks. Big plans for tonight, David?
Yeah. Me and the kids. Yeah. They're going to stay up till 10. I'm going to stay up till 10:30. We're going to rock it.
Yeah. For anybody outside of the UK listening to this, even if we were big-time New Year's people, there would be nowhere for us to go and nothing for us to do because everything's closed. We're not allowed to see anyone. It's the New Year Scrooge's dream, actually. This is the first year of all my years that I don't have to justify or explain myself for not wanting to go clubbing on New Year's Eve. Ironically, this is the one year I actually do want to go clubbing. For the first time in my life, I would give anything to go clubbing. And I've literally never felt that way before, not even close to it.
It'd be quite interesting to see what would happen if you could sort of exchange the two feelings with respective years so that they would align more helpfully.
Oh, God, yeah.
Wouldn't it?
It would have helped me out of some really dire situations in the past. Yeah.
There's a podcast.
Anyway.
New Year's relived.
Should we cover off our tiny wee morsels of news before we get going with aggro? I know you're champing at the bit, David, for aggro, and we will get there very soon because there's not an awful lot of news. What we've got is that Andy Murray is now no longer playing the opening event of the year in Delray Beach. I think you could tell from our reactions when we reported that he was down to play. We were pretty surprised by that. So perhaps not so surprised that he's no longer down to play. We understand, courtesy of Eleanor Crooks from PA, that the press association, that is, that it's not a fitness related withdrawal. We don't know anything further. I assume it's something COVID and travel related, but it's not a fitness related.
Yeah, he has actually put out some quotes to that effect now, and just
breaking.
Said the given the increase in COVID rates and the transatlantic flights involved, I want to minimise the risks ahead of the Australian Open, which does tally with what Dan Evans told me a few days ago, and he pulled out earlier this week, and he was also going to go to Delray at one point, but he just said there are rules about getting into Australia and getting into the Australian Open, which he felt that Delray Beach could potentially compromise, and if he were to pick up the virus there, he may have a real problem, and he felt that the chances of getting it there were that much higher. So on the balance of it all, he would stay in the UK, practice, get ready, and then fly out to Dubai on about the 15th of January. So, and I think that's what Murray's going to do, and they are going to do one of these little practice bubbles between them.
Yeah, as I understand it, there are three locations where Tennis Australia are laying on charter flights into Melbourne. One of them is certainly Dubai. I believe the US one is in LA. So to play Delray Beach, it wouldn't just be a matter of getting to Delray Beach and playing there. You'd then have an internal US flight ahead of you as well, which surely makes it even less of an enticing prospect. So that's that wee morsel of news. We've also got news that Ash Barty and Jennifer Brady are to play doubles together at the Australian Open. Going to go, does that reignited your Brady fire, David?
It has, but I say reignited. It's just been smouldering along ever since the US
You've
Open.
You've been thinking of her non-stop.
And I do hope that there's more of this, though, for the Australian Open. If we're moving the dates as they have and it's going back 3 weeks and everything is thrown up in the air the way it is, one nice little bonus would be if some doubles teams just emerged out of singles players that you wouldn't normally get, and you could just have an added extra to the tournament. So, and I think that's already a big one.
I can see the Express Online headline now. David Law fire for Jennifer Brady continues to smoulder.
Yeah.
Not stop thinking about her for 3 months.
Final bit of news, very, very importantly, is that I put in a phone call shortly before recording to clarify with my dad whether Benoit Paire was allowed on the boat. And his answer, which he'd clearly given some thought, was that he would be too unpredictable to be crew, but he would be very happy if Benoit Paire were waiting for him on shore for a night out after docking.
Yes, I'm very pleased he gave that answer, because if he was on the boat, I don't think I understand the boat.
Agreed. I could hear in his voice that he really wanted for Benoit Paire to show boat-worthy traits, but he takes the boat very seriously, and
See, I'm getting from Matt there that if Benoit Paire had been on the boat, Matt ain't on the boat. He ain't getting on.
Does Matt want to be on
the
boat?
That's the point. He would refuse.
Benoit Paire does not fit the character profile of people who I know are boat crew members.
That's all I'm saying there. As I say, he's not into flashiness, my dad.
Mm. And scenes.
He's not into scenes, not into unpredictability, not into egos. I can't quite remember the three descriptors, but definitely no ego was one of the three defining character traits of someone boatworthy. So there we go, Benoit Paire, if you're listening. My dad continues to throw you bones. And you have an open invitation to party on shore anytime.
I kind of feel that might suit Benoit better anyway. I think he might be happy with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone's happy with that arrangement.
He might turn down his wild card so that he can enter qualifying in the bar.
To play cards.
Yeah. Oh, God. Right, aggro.
Right then, agro, it is time, folks, for really the crowning moment of 2020. We've made you wait 364 days for it, but it is the top 10 greatest agro moments in tennis history. Now, this is not going to be an exhaustive list by any means. This is not scientific. This is us telling you what has made us smile the most. We've selected a definition of aggro which maybe might not be everybody's definition of aggro, but we've avoided sort of sinister and unpleasant aggro. I'm aware there's a lot of that, and maybe we'll cover that in a whole separate podcast, but we've selected sort of pantomime type aggro that has made us smile. And that is the definition we've gone for, and it's our podcast. So if you don't like it, no one else is doing an aggro top 10, so you just have to lump it. This podcast, part one, will be numbers 10 through 6, and you'll have to wait till Monday, till next year, in fact, for the countdown for 5 to 1. David is, I mean, he's actually sort of vibrating with excitement.
I think my first message to you both was about 7:30 a.m. today, wasn't it?
I've done my prep. I'm ready. When are we recording?
So without further ado, yeah. Unless you have anything to add, David.
No, I mean, I was just
the words are just tumbling out of him.
I did one of mine late last night, and my son and my daughter came into the room just as I was sort of researching it, and they just were suddenly wide-eyed about it and wanted to hear all about it. So anyway, I won't give any more away about that. But then this morning, yes, I was up at 7 and finishing off the second one, and knowing that I still got 7 hours to go until I could actually talk about them. So now's the moment. Brilliant.
I'm going to have to make you wait a little bit longer, David, because I'm going first. Okay. With number 10. And I'm going to take you back to 2014 and Dubai, the quarterfinal between Serena Williams and Jelena Jankovic. Serena is 6-2, 5-2 up on Jelena Jankovic, and Jankovic is love 40 down on her serve. So she's facing 3 match points. It's been a bit of a drubbing up until this point. It's been a tetchy match. But given how uncompetitive it was, there was no specific aggro or anything like that. But Jankovic had her gripes with umpire Cardinuni, but nothing particularly specific. So she's love 40 down. She saves 2 match points to get to 30-40. She then gets irritated with umpire Cardinuni over something unknown, frankly, and this is a clip of the coverage, and watch out here for some splendid comic timing from the late great commentator David Mercer.
I don't know what that conversation was all about between umpire and Jankovic. She's been unhappy about everything tonight. Shame.
It's so good. So like a disappointed parent. So poor David Mercer is already growing irritated and tired, particularly with Jelena Jankovic. She then proceeds Jankovic to save the 3rd match point and get it back to deuce. Then she heads to the baseline to serve at deuce, at which point Serena coughs, delaying Jankovic's service motion by, I would say, less than a second. Jankovic doesn't like it, and David Mercer doesn't like that Jankovic doesn't like it.
Oh, now we've got gamesmanship going on. Williams held her up for a fraction. Jankovic doesn't like that. Oh, do shut up, Jelena. Drives me insane. And Serena's not at all amused by that remark. Oh, come on. We don't need this.
This is pathetic.
So the theme of irritated parent dealing with what my parents used to not so fondly call horseplay continues. In case you didn't catch that, after the cough, Yankovic turns her back on Serena, walks to the back of the court yelling, "You can take more time, it's yours." Serena responds by saying, "Do you want to do this again, Yelena?" Which is apparently referring to two almost identical incidents from the Family Circle Cup in the States the previous year and one in Rome going all the way back to 2010. I love how vivid and deep tennis players' memories are.
What's the Family Circle Cup? Is that Charleston?
Yes, it's right. What was Charleston, yeah. So Yankovic, of course, loses the match 6-2, 6-2 in 56 minutes. I mean, it was never even remotely competitive. They have a long chat at the net, which unfortunately isn't picked up by the mics. Serena actually comes round to Yankovic's side of the net for it. All the while during the coverage, and this is all available on YouTube, Annabelle Croft, the interviewer, is lurking in the background and... yeah, unfortunately, the clip cuts off before that interview takes place. So I've no idea what was asked about. But Annabelle didn't look like she was particularly looking forward to the interview. And the only disappointment for me in this, and it's probably why it's only in at number 10, because it's really fantastically childish aggro, really pantomimey, and that's so wonderfully captured by David Mercer's commentary. The reason it's not better is because they kind of backed off from it when asked about it after the match. They didn't sort of own it because there's clearly, or at that stage, I don't know what they're like now, there was clearly no love lost. You know, these two weren't mates. There was a history there and it clearly was personal. You know, Serena saying, "Do you want to do this again, Yelena?" Unfortunately, Serena, after the match, said, "I told her at the end, look, I didn't mean anything. I'm sorry if I played slow." She was like, "No, it was more like they say I play too fast and then too slow." She said she couldn't get it right. I was like, "Look, are we cool? Because I'm cool with you. I don't want them to be cool with one another." No.
They weren't really, Catherine.
It's well, fine. Exactly. But just say that. It's fine not to be cool with one another.
That's like when Kerber backed down from calling Andreescu the biggest drama queen ever.
Oh, why haven't we got that in?
Because she backed down.
Yeah. How did she back down again? Didn't she sort of say, "Oh, I meant it as a compliment"?
She put out a corporate tweet saying, yeah, "Congratulations on an excellent win. Good luck in the next round."
And then Kyrgios called her out on it.
Yeah, that's a very worthy honourable mention. Yeah, it really bothered me when I was researching this one that I found those quotes from Serena after the match. I was really hoping to find some sort of Hingis-like quotes.
It's so much fun. I mean, look, I think I commentated on that match, or I've commentated on another Yankovic one with some aggro in it. I think it was
Did
that
you
one
say
there.
The word pathetic?
No.
Shut
I mean, look, David's commentary was way better than whatever I mustered at the time. But... it is very, very fun to commentate on moments like that. I mean, if it gets really unpleasant, obviously, you know, that's another matter, and hence why things like that aren't really in our lineup. But just stay out of the way if ever you're commentating on one of those. Just let it go, unless you've got a David Mercer line like that that's going to actually elevate it, as his did. No, that's just fantastic.
It's funny listening to that clip. It's as though the audience is hearing David Mercer's commentary because he says his lines and then suddenly there's a big applause from the crowd.
Yeah, you're saying what we're thinking.
Yeah.
So that's in at 10. In at 9, it's over to you, Matt.
Yes. This one, I think, is kind of legendary on the WTA tour. And this is a match between Sara Errani and Elise Cornet in Toronto 2013. In which Irani would eventually win 7-5, 7-6. But the incident occurs a couple of hours in, and I think I might as well just play the clip here. So this is what happens 2 hours into their match.
What's going on there?
So, in case that wasn't clear, that is Sara Irani taking issue with Cornet saying Bamos instead of Ale as her way of exclaiming. What I love about this is, again, it's sort of wonderfully petty. And I almost sensed that Irani was really annoyed by it the whole match. It had been kind of building up, and then suddenly she just decided to have a go at Cornet about this. And I guess she's kind of got a point, right? I mean, why aren't you speaking your native language? It is provocative. It is to trying to wind someone up. But I don't really get why Cornet is saying Bamos, given that Irani is Italian and Bamos is Spanish. None of it quite makes sense, which is why it's sort of so wonderful.
They're both, in quite different ways, Irani and Cornet, they've both been involved in their fair share of aggro, haven't they? I remember vividly a match between Elise Cornet and Tatiana Maria in the first round of the French Open 4 or 5 years ago, when Elise Cornet had some treatment for what looked like cramp, but obviously she didn't declare that it was cramp because you're not allowed treatment for cramp. And Tatiana Maria went nuts about it on the court, and then I was actually moderating her press conference afterwards, and I was expecting Serena style her to back away from it. And she just laid into her. She said she was going to consult lawyers. I think it was in an untranscribed room. So only the journalist that had actually attended that press conference heard it. And obviously none of that happened. It was all heat of the moment stuff, but she said, yeah, I've already spoken to a lawyer, I'm going to see what I can do. It was immense. And of course Irani, I mean, most recently we had Irani at the French Open this year, didn't we, with Kiki Bertens. That was pretty immense.
Yes, any Irani section needs to, we need to tip our cap to that moment.
What happened there?
I mean, that whole match was ridiculous. That was the match with, I think Irani had 70 aborted ball tosses, maybe even more. Several underarm serves, really dramatic. And basically, Bertens was cramping the whole match all over her body. And it was actually a little bit distressing to watch because it did look like she was in a lot of pain. Irani didn't think so. Irani thought she was absolutely faking it. And when the match concluded, Irani whacked the ball basically out of Roland Garros, didn't do a racket tap, packed her bags and left the court swearing in Italian, of course. She was swearing in her own language.
Didn't she do a sort of physical impersonation?
Yes, she did. Yeah, that
Burns.
Happened as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then she went into the press conference and definitely didn't back down. Definitely doubled down on Burton's faking
it. Oh, yes, she said,
it.
Oh, I've just seen her eating. She didn't look like she was cramping.
Yeah, she said you saw her leave the court in a chair and now she's eating and fine in the players'
people
area.
With cramp don't eat.
it does amuse me the way players just become absolutely paranoid about what their opponent is up to. They can't possibly take it at face value at all if they're losing. I mean, Cornet is known for it. I've spoken to one or two players that have played her. I remember commentating with Anne Kyotovong, and when Cornet would start to do anything, Anne would make you know that this is how she is. This is to be expected.
Congratulations, Anne, on your MBE, by the way. I don't know if she listens, but Anne Kyotovong has been awarded an MBE in the New Year's honours list.
Yeah,
so
great
congratulations
news.
To her.
Yes, and just a final word on the Irani Cornet, why you say Bamos incident. They then met again at Wimbledon a few years later, which I think was an aggro-free match, disappointingly. But I did notice that Cornet on her Instagram the day before that match said, next up at Wimbledon, hashtag why you say Bamos.
Oh, that's sensational. Yeah, I like it when they own it.
Yeah, yes. Lean into it.
Yeah. Look at David with all his newfangled expressions.
I've been listening to lots of Around the NFL podcast where they use expressions like lean into it.
Right.
I don't really know what it means, but that's all right.
It's coined by Sheryl Sandberg, I think.
I'm leaning into it anyway.
Did she coin it or did she just borrow it? I think she coined it, didn't she?
I haven't a clue, Catherine.
Right. I think she, in my head, she coined it, but that could be a completely, completely
you might
recent,
have coined that
recentist
idea.
Take. Yes. Shall we move on to number seven?
Yeah.
Yes. And this is one of my absolute favourites. This is the 2015 Australian Open and Kim Sears, Thomas Burdick and Andy Murray. Little saga involving them. And actually, the Australian Open account on YouTube has clipped this incident up, their official account, and made a little video package of aggro out of it. And it's had about 400,000 views on there. So they clearly recognise aggro being, quote-unquote, good for the sport.
That is top-notch content creation. Well done.
Yes. Now, the background for this is that Danny Valverde, you know, Murray's longtime friend, coach, hitting partner, various roles within Murray's team, had left to become Thomas Burdick's main coach in November 2014. And then just a few months later, they're obviously meeting in this high-stakes semi-final at the Australian Open.
A match to decide who got to lose to Djokovic. Those were the stakes.
Yes, as basically any Australian Open semi-final has been. And of course, quite naturally, I suppose, I think the press really seized on that angle going into this match of Murray versus Valverde in a way. And I think Murray accused the British press of stoking the fire and fanning the flames a little bit and creating the tension, or certainly escalating it, even if it was probably already there.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, which thereby sort of completely justifies them doing it, doesn't it?
Oh, totally. Anyway, the match starts. Burdick's playing really well. He is serving for the first set. But Murray breaks back and gives a really strong, come on, raw, you know, really emotional. And then the camera swivels to his player box and picks out Kim Sears. Now, I don't think it was ever 100% conclusive with what she'd actually said, but it was definitely take that you, and then lots of words beginning with F directed at Thomas Burdick. And another mention for Anki Ottavong. She was one of the many who immediately took to Twitter and called it hilarious. And Burdick then ended up winning this set. It went to a tie break. Murray squandered some set points. And then there was a bit of argy-bargy between the players at the changeover. Murray accused Burdick of saying something to him, and Thomas Burdick just said, "No, all I said was well played, Thomas," out loud. Pascal Maria was in the chair. He had to slightly diffuse the situation. But that was kind of the high point of the aggro, that first set. After that, it actually calmed down, and Murray ended up winning the match in four sets, played brilliantly. And then he was asked about the tension in his on-court interview. But I think anyone who was watching that match, anyone who was there in the stadium, could feel additional tension around this match. And Jim Courier asked Murray about it. And Murray said, "Yes, there's extra tension. It's a big match. A lot was made of Danny, my ex-coach, working with Thomas. We've been friends for 15 years, and I felt like it was a little bit unfair and unnecessary. It created too much tension, especially at the beginning, but then everyone calmed down after the match." And that was a theme that Murray very much carried on in his post-match press conference, said similar things.
What's he saying is unfair and unnecessary?
The British press...
David's stoking of the fires.
Yeah. David Law.
I mean, I was commentating on the match, and I can guarantee you I was hyping it up for all it was worth. And look, the moment that Burdick decided to get involved with that, because he was playing beautifully, he was playing great tennis, and he was a match for Murray. And the moment that he decided to go nose-to-nose with Murray and create some aggro, quite honestly, I'm pretty sure if we played it back, we were saying, you're going to lose. Because now you're playing, now you're in Murray's perfect environment. This is where he improves. He will get better as a result of this.
So actually, you did Murray a favour.
Yeah.
You just didn't realise
it. I think
so.
Yeah. Yeah. Incidentally, that was also the post-match interview where Murray really spoke out in defence of Amélie Mauresmo. That was the one where he said, we've shown this week that women can be good coaches as well. And Madison Keys is in the semi-final. She's also coached by a woman in Lindsay Davenport. And I hope this is a trend that continues. It was a real statement that he made. And I think that was part of Murray's frustration as well. I think he wanted the focus to be on how well he was doing with Mauresmo rather than his old coach being part of Burdick's team now. But then the absolute best thing of all about this whole incident is what Kim wears to the final against Djokovic a few days later, where she sort of makes her way into the player box. She's picked out by the camera again, and she is wearing the now iconic jumper that says parental advisory, explicit content.
Which I believe she'd spotted while she'd been walking the night before,
yeah,
and seen that and just decided to buy it as a joke, didn't she? And to just sort of shove it up everybody. And the thing is, I was there for BBC Radio, and my job for the day was to go down into the player area for when they came out of the locker room and describe their walk to the court. And whilst there, I remember Team Murray walking past me, of which Kim was one of them. And so I was the first person to see her before she was seen in this top. And I didn't see the top, which is a terrible shame because I could have broken the bloody story. But instead, I'd got all of Team Murray giving me sort of knowing looks and smiles as if to say, have you seen what she's wearing? Isn't it funny? I hadn't clocked it. I had no idea why they were all smiling at me. Not whatsoever. And then I saw this on the TV and I realised I've just missed a great scoop.
Unlike you, David.
Well, I mean, probably the angle I was looking at.
And ever since then, have you just been overanalyzing the tops that everyone's wearing just in case you're missing some kind of really newsworthy gag?
Can't say I have, no. But I do regret on this occasion.
It was that picture of Kim in that top was front page of a lot of the papers the next day. I can't remember which ones exactly, but It was front page in the UK.
As was the lip reading of what she'd said in the semi-final. That was all over the papers as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and again, it's all crowned by the fact that she just owned it.
Yeah. That makes it so much better.
Yeah. Own the aggro.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
Look, well, David's about to spontaneously combust. Yes. So we'd better let him have a go.
I've already barged in on Matt's and Catherine's goes, so here we are.
David.
Yeah.
Well, over to you, in at number seven.
Is Andy Roddick and Novak Djokovic in 2008.
Did I say seven to you before, Matt, when I meant eight? I think I've got my counting. I think I failed on the counting. But anyway, David, sorry.
I don't remember seven. You doing so. So Andy Roddick against Novak Djokovic in 2008. It's the US Open quarterfinals. Djokovic is 21 years of age. He's recently won the Australian Open, his first Grand Slam title, and he's up against Roddick in the final eight for the right to meet Roger Federer in the semifinals. Djokovic had just beaten Tommy Robredo in five sets in the previous rounds, and afterwards Robredo had complained about Djokovic calling for the trainer so often. Roddick then came into his press conference after his win, and the following exchange took place. He was asked, regarding Novak's injuries today that he's been talking about, the right ankle as opposed to the left ankle, and Roddick interrupted and said, isn't it both of them? And a back and a hip. He's asked, and when he said there are too many to count, Andy Roddick, and a cramp, bird flu. He's got a pretty long list of illnesses.
Sorry, Irani-esque.
Roddick says, anthrax, SARS, common cough and cold. So do you think he's bluffing? No, I mean, look, if it's there, it's there. There's just a lot. You know, he's either quick to call a trainer or he's the most courageous guy of all time. I think it's up for you guys to decide. So that exchange happens in the Roddick press conference before Novak Djokovic and he are about to take to the court. They come out for their quarterfinal. It's a brilliant match. Roddick is two sets to love down. Djokovic plays the most majestic first two sets to win them 6-2, 6-3. Roddick hits back, wins the third 6-3, and serves to take it into a fifth. And frankly, chokes. He hits two double faults from 30 love up, loses his serve, Roddick, having served brilliantly all day, goes into a tie break. Djokovic wins the tie break. Afterwards, and bear in mind that this was the final match that the USA Network in the United States would cover of the US Open after more than 20 years of having the rights. They're about to lose the rights to ESPN. This was their final match of coverage. And onto the court comes their reporter, Michael Barkin, and speaks to Novak Djokovic. This is what it sounded like.
Novak, great match. You're back to your second straight U.S. Open semifinal. Way to be. What's your thoughts tonight?
Thanks for my box and all the fans who were supporting me tonight. I know there were not more than Roddick's, but I'm really happy, you know, playing against Roddick and his court and in his ambient, and this is like his city, his favorite tournament, so to win against him is a huge effort.
I'm sure it was. The first two sets, you came out smoking, and then what happened in the third set there? I thought it might just be three.
Well, obviously, you know, Andy was saying that I have 16 injuries on the last match, so obviously I don't, right?
Didn't look like it.
Yeah, well, yeah. Like it or not, I mean, it's like that. So,
you know, you get this crowd loves you. You could turn them against you real fast, you know.
Well, I know they're already against me because they think I'm faking everything, so sorry.
Well, no, no one said that. The only one who said that, the only one who intimated that was Andy. And Andy said he was kind of joking around about it. Did that fuel your fire?
That's not nice anyhow to say, you know, in front of this crowd that I have 16 injuries and I'm faking. You know, I have nothing against anybody. It's just that the momentum is not nice.
And was that the reason you came out the way you did? You started out so strongly tonight. Were you thinking about that?
No, I wasn't thinking about it. You know, I was just trying to get involved in the match and just trying to work on my returns, and everything was going well.
And now Roger Federer next. You're 2-6 against him, but you beat him in the semifinals of the Australian. Showed you could do it. Your thoughts on that semifinal matchup, Novak?
Well, he's an absolute favorite, you know, in that match. Of course, I lost to him last year, so he's a great player, you know, now ex-number one, but it's for him, it's a big challenge to go back to the number one spot of the world, so it's going to be a nice match.
All right, Novak, thanks a lot. Hey, have a little applause.
That's okay.
I tried. Ted, John, it's been a pleasure.
You too, Michael, and that is a weird way to go out, Teddy, I think, after all these years, and a bit of a shame.
Yeah, so
not a shame at all.
I mean, of all people, John McEnroe looking down on the aggro.
that is so much worse than I remember it.
Yeah, it was extreme at the time, and it was really uncomfortable as well. I mean, you know, watching it again, I think I was commentating on the match, and it's just, you're like, oh my word, what are you saying that for? This lot are just going for him.
As I remember it, and this could be wrong, but it's kind of backed up by some of the questions there from the interviewer, the crowd weren't that anti-Djokovic throughout the match. I mean, obviously they were pro-Roddick, but it's not like some of the anti-Djokovic crowds that we've seen sort of latterly that Djokovic does kind of rightly get annoyed about.
No.
I don't remember it feeling like that.
I always thought the US Open crowd in that portion of his career really liked Djokovic. It was the year before he'd done all those impressions and kind of embraced him.
This was revisited in the aftermath of this incident. And I mean, I think you're right. They were very pro-Roddick, but he was worked up about what Roddick had said. That was the point. And he came out, even in his pre-match interview, which I watched, he was already, you could tell, bristling about what he'd been accused of. And he was the way he took Roddick out in those first two sets, he was playing angry tennis. He was absolutely fantastic tennis, and he fought off the comeback. But afterwards, Roddick came into the press conference and he was asked about it, and he says, "Look, you've clearly ticked him off with things you've said about SARS and bird flu and all that sort of thing, and he's just spoken about it on the court. What's your reaction?" And Roddick said, "Look, I think you guys knew it was completely meant in jest." He said, "I figure if you're going to joke and imitate other people and do the whole deal, then you should be able to take it yourself. Listen, if someone makes fun of me, I'm going to laugh about it." And he felt that Djokovic should have been able to take it, given a year ago he'd been impersonating all the other players, including Roddick. And Djokovic had taken a bit of stick about those impersonations from other players. Roddick says, "I'm sorry you took it that way. There's nothing else to say. I didn't think it was over the line. It wasn't my intention, and I'm sorry if he felt that way. Maybe I did him a favour tonight. If someone wants to focus in on that and use it," meaning Djokovic, "then by all means. But especially in Novak's case, if you're going to dish out all that stuff, then be able to take it with a smile. It's the only part that I don't quite agree with." He was then asked, "Have you had an opportunity to talk to him since the match?" He says, "Anything that's going to be said between Novak and I is going to stay between Novak and I, because I'm not going to air out our private conversations in front of you guys." Djokovic then comes into the press conference and is asked all about it. And he's quite emotional by this point, quite upset, I think, and quite a little bit overwhelmed about the fuss that he's kind of created, and I think he was a little taken aback by the degree to which the fans got on his back, because a year earlier they'd all been really loving him for his impersonations. He'd actually done them out on court. John McEnroe had been out there and he'd been playing a rally with him, and it had been all fun and games. And he sort of apologises for if he overreacted, etc. There's been a lot of emotions the last couple of days with my medical timeouts and all that sort of thing. And he actually points out in his post-match press conference that a year earlier he'd done these impersonations and realised that he better not do them anymore because he'd obviously annoyed some of the players. And that was a very clear moment of Novak Djokovic changing his entire public persona in front of us, the media, and I think in front of the world generally. He stopped being playful like that and he became quite guarded and quite suspicious, I think, of things. And I think he didn't understand why everybody was getting on his back about him calling the trainer. He felt, if I've got an injury, I should be able to get it treated. That's all I'm doing. He was asked afterwards, have you spoken to Andy in the locker room? Yes, but this is just between us, he says. Fast forward 5 years. Andy Roddick has retired. He's on the TV channel in the United States, Fox Sports Live, in 2013. And they're discussing backroom aggro, back sort of locker room aggro. And he said in the show, I got into an in-the-locker-room after-a-match confrontation with a tennis player one time. I won't say his name. I'll just say it rhymes with Shmovak Shmokovic. And we got into it at the US Open one time. I was kind of talking trash and he came out and beat the pants off me as he would, but then kind of chirped afterward and he came straight in and I went right up to him in the locker room and had him up against the locker. Then I realised his trainer was a little bit bigger than an NFL quarterback and I kind of checked myself. My trainer is about 5'8" and 130 pounds and can dodge raindrops. I kind of backed off real quick. I was about to get railroaded from the side. Roddick, this then blew up into headlines about the fact that he basically had a fight with Novak Djokovic in the locker room after this match 5 years earlier. And Roddick tweeted, there is no feud, normal athlete emotional stuff that is instantly regrettable. Ha ha ha. Joker Noel and I have been okay for a long time.
I think it's Joker Nole.
Yeah, oh yeah. Joker Noel. Sorry,
David, you're
right.
We don't want to get... Well, yeah.
Yes, I
mean, we're already going to get abuse just for covering this, aren't we? But let's not.
No, it's
let's
good.
Not add to it.
But I actually find it quite an interesting period of seeing how Djokovic was trying to work out who he was on the landscape of professional tennis. He, you know, he'd been doing these impersonations. They went down well. They were funny. They went down well with us anyway. But they annoyed certain players in the locker room, and it scared him off doing them.
If Andy Roddick's saying that sort of thing is normal and happens all the time, I want to hear about some of the other times that happening.
Well, I've certainly heard other players, certainly from the past, when we were on the Champions Tour, Catherine, players would talk about the fact that we would just have it out in the locker room. I think there were quite a lot of locker room punch-ups. And
you think actual punch-ups?
I've seen one or two, you know. Just people going sort of nose to nose and, you know, yeah.
If you can't say names, can you say what they rhyme with?
Yes. Come on.
No, I mean, no, I can't.
Oh.
but I mean, you know, I mean, when you talk
give
to...
It, give it, can we play like a guessing game? If we guess it, are we allowed to know?
No.
Oh, come on.
when you talk to people like Pat Cash, though, and those Ooh. Guys, they will tell you, and he wasn't involved, they will tell you that stuff would happen in the locker room, you know, and they'd put it behind them pretty quickly after that. But I did enjoy covering that. And I just find it fascinating for the evolution of Novak Djokovic. Is it from a young man trying to become a champion and find out where he fits in that group?
Feels like a big moment in his career in terms of how it changed certainly his public persona. Personally, my favourite Djokovic was always the one that embraced being the guy breaking up the Federer and Nadal dominance.
The party pooper.
Yeah, I thought that was his role. And he had an ability to play that role brilliantly. And I always go back to what Janko Tipsarevic said in that interview you did with him last year, David, that Djokovic does want to be loved. And him getting booed on the Arthur Ashe Stadium probably really rocked him and probably did change him.
He said, once you win a Grand Slam title, you get more attention from everybody. It's logical. I don't want to make impersonations anymore. That's not what I want to do. People get it wrong. People got it wrong when I did it. They got the wrong end of the stick, is what he's saying. And I was in situations I didn't want to be in, fighting with people, with the press. This is absolutely not me. And that's one of the reasons why I stopped doing it. And you can tell that he's trying to work out, well, what should I be? And I think he ended up thinking too hard, because I agree with you. I mean, look, first of all, those first two sets against Roddick, when he's playing angry tennis, he was unstoppable. And we've seen that against Federer when he's been having the whole crowd against him and he's managed to win. Those are the parts that I admire the most.
Mm. God, that is great aggro. Because some aggro's great because it's spontaneous, but there's also good aggro when there's plot lines and storylines, and you can track it throughout history.
For the on-court interviewer as well, Michael Barkan, who just was fantastic. He he read that and just stoked it up a little bit, but had the most brilliant delivery, proper reporter, you know. Really, I loved his interviews.
Yeah, where is he now?
Well, sadly, when they lost the rights, he stopped doing that.
Bring him back.
And I want to track him down. Mary Carrillo will know him.
So. 2021 can and be Ted the year Robinson. Of Michael Barkan.
Yeah. They're both colleagues of his, and I think he's brilliant.
I'm hoping numbers 1 through 6 are decent, because
we might have peaked.
I'm thinking number 7 should have been a bit higher. That was top notch, David.
Good. Well, do you want to hear 6?
Full disclosure on number 6. Is that it was actually supposed to be something different. I won't tell you what, because it's going to be in the next pod. But David got overexcited on this entry and prepped completely the wrong one, because he was just beside himself. He found the clip, he sent it to me, showed it to his kids. So we've done a bit of a jumble, and this is what's come out at number 6.
It's John McEnroe, everybody, and he's up against Anders Järryd in the Stockholm Open in November 1984. McEnroe was having the year of his life. He'd won Wimbledon, the US Open. He'd only lost one match since that loss that we covered on Tennis Relived against Ivan Lendl in the final of the French Open. So you're talking a good 5 months undefeated, apart from one match in Cincinnati, I think, against Vijay Amritraj. He'd won 12 titles. He was on a 17-match winning streak. But he was pretty much running on empty by the time he came up against Anders Järryd. And he lost the first set 6-1. And then this happened.
Right on the line. No mistakes so far in this match, right? You haven't overruled anything. No mistakes whatsoever.
Second serve,
please. Answer my question! The question, jerk!
McEnroe somehow went on to win that match, but I mean, it was, I think whenever anybody thinks about McEnroe, they think of You Cannot Be Serious. And I was watching that back as well. But when I showed it, my kids did come in and wanted to just see what I was messing around with on the computer. And when I played it for my nine-year-old son, he started off thinking it was funny. And then the moment McEnroe goes, answer the question, like this, my son was scared, really scared. And this is the effect I think he did have on people within a stadium. They would make that you would feel uncomfortable, and now it's really quite funny because we know all the story and the backdrop and everything else that goes with it. But it did make you feel uncomfortable at the time. He went on and he won that match. He won the final against Mats Wilander, but he ended up being suspended for 21 days as a result of that outburst. Because whilst the audio is fantastic, what you don't see is him going back to his chair, smashing an ice bucket off the table with his racket twice. Once that draws those cries from the crowd, and then another one as a direct reaction to them, as if to say, what, you think that was good? Have some of this. So he gets banned for 21 days, misses a tournament, still comes back for the Davis Cup. And he says in his autobiography that he was fined $700, and he was trying to work out what he would actually have to do to get banned properly, because he said, I was at the point where I was basically pushing them to find out, and they wouldn't ban me. And he said, the answer is simple. It's just not so pure. They had to put a show on, and my presence put behinds in the seats. It happened at tournament after tournament. I would freak out. The umpire would hit me with a warning, a point penalty, maybe a measly fine or two in a year when I was earning a couple of million dollars. $700 was pocket change. And then life would go on. If I went home, they lost money. The tournament directors knew it. The umpires knew it. The linesmen knew it. I knew it. The system let me get away with more and more. And even though to some it looked as if I was glorying in my bad behaviour, I really liked it less and less.
Well, tournaments must really depend on Sam Querrey for income, then.
Sam Querrey, that's the other bit of news, isn't it? He's just had a $20,000 fine suspended for 6 months for good behaviour
becoming an international COVID fugitive.
Yes, yep. That's probably the best way to put it. But anyway,
It's no ice bucket incident, though, is it?
No.
By the way, amazing segue.
The Tennis Majors website wrote up this incident from the 80s with McEnroe, and they've got a quote here from the umpire of that match, Leif Ake Nielsen, who would admit 25 years later that he still didn't have the answer to McEnroe's question. He wanted an answer to his question, but I couldn't find any. If I could have found an answer to his question, which I think was there have been no bad calls in this match, I should have done it. But even today, I don't know what to answer. I just didn't know what to say. That's why I said, second serve, please.
Oh, bless him. Talk about sent into the firing line.
McEnroe would later call his Stockholm tantrum his most embarrassing memory. And he says, but when asked if he remembered the umpire, his response was, I don't remember any particular chair umpire. They were all equally bad. So that was John McEnroe at his best and his worst.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure loads of people will say, I can't believe you don't have You Cannot Be Serious. I'm sure there's a You Cannot Be Serious gag in there somewhere, if not many of them. And, you know, of course, that was a great moment of aggro. But this one we found funnier, didn't we? There was a childishness and a pantomiminess to this one that was just really epic and kind of, yeah, it did feel like the zenith of John McEnroe aggro.
And the way he's putting his arms out wide to the referee is if to say, are we done? Is that it? are you gonna disqualify me or not? You know, just challenging them. Amazing.
And very... very well captured by the slow-mo of him knocking the ice off the little table.
Yes. If you want to look at the YouTube clip, wait till the end. Watch it through to the end, because they do this really slow motion of McEnroe's really quite elegant stroke.
Yes, he puts another hand on the racket. Yeah. He never used two hands for anything.
No. It's like a kind of golf swing. It's really a thing of beauty. He's put quite a lot of thought into that. So that is 10 to 6 on the countdown of tennis's greatest, almost amusing aggro, our favourite aggro over the years. I know what you're thinking. How good must numbers 1 through 5 be? Well, tune in on Monday to find out. David, you've got to wait 4 days. Can you handle it?
Yeah, maybe. Hopefully I'll get the right one in the right slot this time.
Yes, if you could do that, that would be great.
Are we doing it on Monday? I'm not sure we are.
Why wouldn't we be doing it on Monday?
I think we might be doing a season preview on Monday.
Oh.
Correct.
And Tennis Aggro 2 on Thursday.
A week
right.
today.
Oh my goodness, you have to wait a week. Right. We'll go and discuss that schedule.
This is the 11th entry, folks, when we sort this out.
You will get part 2, I promise, within the week. Can
yes,
I pledge
sure.
to that? Yes, within the week we'll get past part 2 of Tennis Aggro. And if you just, you know, want to call David and talk about Tennis Aggro, he's available anytime. I think he'll cancel his plans for you. Thank you once again. I know I keep saying it. Thank you for your support in our 2021 Kickstarter. It's still open if you want to get yourself an intro or a shout out, or just buy us a beer, support us, be part of the team for 2021. We are overwhelmed, as I keep saying, by the support that we've received, and so touched by so many of your messages as well. We're really hoping that 2021 brings good things. But even if it doesn't, it will bring good podcasts. We promise you that. So happy new year from all of us, and we'll see you on the other side.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.